And after a week's absence, because he was unreachable, it is time to bring in David Terechuk. It is time for the Media Beat. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, has his own website, a terrific website, themediabeat.us. And he was traveling last week and in an area without great phone service or, of course, internet service, but he's back in the media capital of the world. Good morning, David.
Good morning to you. Yes, I'm back in New York City, that media capital of the world. I'm so happy to be able to say that hackneyed phrase of mine every time that I am able to. And yes, I'm reachable. I'm reachable in New York City. I was in Ireland, and I was actually in a part of Ireland where we were having difficulty connecting. So I'm so glad to be back in connection with you. But it's I'm suffering a little bit of culture shock, I have to say.
Why would you think so?
Ireland at the time was I was in Ireland, which is very tightened for its restrictions for COVID are very tightened, and those tight conditions were extended off into some distant date, not so distant, mid-April or so, and I arrived back to the United States to find that one of our biggest states, Texas, is lifting its restrictions entirely, its state restrictions at least entirely, as is Mississippi, and also in Massachusetts to a lesser degree, with particular things like restaurants opening again, though at low capacity, and indoor performance areas too. That's what greets me as a major piece of news. And of course the new president's, United States president's reaction to that, calling it, in the Texas example of it anyway, calling it Neanderthal thinking about the Texan governor in particular, I think, which I fear may be defamatory to Neanderthals, that is.
That's right. You know, Connecticut's releasing and relaxing things, but there's two things they're not relaxing, and that is you got to wear face masks. There's just no ifs, ands, or about it, and you have to be appropriately separated by 6 feet or more. They are slowly increasing other things because our infection rate is down to about 1.8%. But the thing that amazes me is the governor of South Dakota, who keeps talking about how free and open and wow they are. That per capita has the highest amount of COVID in the country. And, of course, that was the location where that big bike rally was held, where a couple hundred thousand people showed up and then spread out through the rest of the United States. You know, we're on such a decent path now with vaccinations, with the rapid testing and all of that. You just hate to see cracks in that armor.
Sure. The comparison with where I've just been is telling. As I say, the restrictions there were extended up until at least mid-April. And this was happening at a time, this decision was taken at a time when Ireland's figures, never very high in the first place, were also on a trajectory going down. New cases, hospitalizations, deaths, all going down. And yet, the cabinet committee responsible for the COVID measures decided no, we're not going to loosen up yet. We're going to be careful. And of course, across the Irish Sea in Great Britain, too, some things are opening up, schools in particular, under a plan announced last week by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But even that figure, that often vilified figure for his recklessness and his lack of forethought, placed a very heavy emphasis on doing all of this opening up very carefully and very slowly, watching it, monitoring what its immediate impact might be week by week, and maybe reversing the decision. He even raised that possibility of reversing the opening process. It's a very different picture over here, and I would venture to suggest that the recklessness quotient is definitely higher.
You know, it's interesting. I think when we look at COVID and we look at COVID-19 in this country, the way hospitals are handling COVID now and treating COVID now, the death rate for people that get COVID and have to go to the hospital is not nearly what it was. But there is a great story. I don't know if you can Google it, because I don't know if it'll show up on the web. The Berkshire Eagle did a story on these students that interviewed four centenarians in a local nursing home, okay, during the course of the pandemic. Now, three of those...
That's 100-year-olds and 90-year-olds?
Now, three of those people passed away, not due to COVID, okay, but they passed away during this. But they put they put together this report, and it's these women call themselves two-timers. They've been through two pandemics. They've been through the first one that we had 100 years ago.
And this one, so-called Spanish flu.
And this one, and it was just a very touching story, and it was great that these students put together the lives of these women, and they said, "Stay safe, wear a hat." Was the main was their commentary. But you know, it's when you look
very sensible.
When you look at it, it was just a terrific story, and once again, it was put together by college students that just put together a real great idea. I want to go out of this country for a second and talk about a story, a couple of different stories. One is the Pope. The Pope is in Iraq, and it I guess you could say, like anything nowadays, if you go to a country like Iraq, it's risky. What does the world think about the Pope and his visit to Iraq?
Mixed feelings, I'd say, from the kind of coverage it's getting. The media in general tend to play up papal visits enormously. And of course, they are an occasion for mass hysteria, almost, in many places that he visits. May not be the case in Iraq. The audience, his most direct audience, is a Christian community whose size has diminished extraordinarily in the last 5-6 years, from about 1.5 million Christians who hold to the Eastern Orthodoxy, of course, in the main. They're way down now after a lot of persecution by extremists who have the upper hand in that area. Down now to little more than 250,000. So it's a huge shrinkage in very few years. But of course, there'll be plenty enough for the kind of papal crowds that the Pope gets when he visits, or at least he and his not quite immediate past predecessor, but two popes ago, Pope Paul John II was renowned for the hugeness of the rallies that he managed to recruit to himself, and it's going to be pretty sizable. All the public events will be pretty sizable, but they're attempting, they say, to ensure lots of safety restrictions there. Everybody in the Pope's own party, including himself, have been immunized. They've had the vaccine. That cannot be said, of course, for the much more chaotic situation amongst the people that he's going to be speaking to in mass crowds, although, you know, social distancing rules will be attempted. So I think people's general reaction is to say, well, he's in his own words, he is a pastor for the least privileged in the world, the poor, the disenfranchised, and of course the vulnerable. So it, in one sense, looked at it from the Vatican's own eyes, this is a perfectly sensible thing to do and a perfectly sensible place to go to. But of course, many in the media are saying that it's one of those cases where it's just too risky. Couldn't he have waited just a few more months? And I think that's kind of an open question.
All right. Now next, and this goes, I'm going to go to Italy. And what do people think about this? Italy now has decided to block 250,000 doses of the AstraZeneca virus serum from leaving the country. They don't want these vaccinations to leave the country until if they're produced in the country, they want them to stay in the country. Does that go against any EU rules or anything like that?
Well, it's cropped up once before in the case of Britain and the EU, because of course Britain had left the EU during this pandemic time, and of course at one point there was a kind of nasty spat about just this, that there was a threat from the EU that they would not allow vaccines produced in EU countries to go to Britain because well, they had their own reasons, and the outrage that provoked resulted in an almost reversal of that threat. It was never enacted anyway, but the threat was made for, say, a day or two, and it's had its effect and raised that question, which this Italian example is raising once again, the whole idea of nationalism in vaccine form. And in this particular case, it's Australia who was the destined destination for this batch of, well, very large batch of Italian-produced vaccines, and Australia is annoyed, of course, but at least there's one soothing point in this, which Australia's own Prime Minister raised, which is that Australia doesn't really need that many. One, the population is not so great, and two, they've never had, except for very early on, any substantial substantially rampant example of the disease running through its various states. One state recently had a very short shutdown, but in general, Australia is one of those very lucky countries at the top of the list of places that have handled the situation really well. Easier, perhaps, in the sense of its, you know, certain degree of geographical isolation. But the other thing is that is that they've already taken steps to ensure that they get that they have already gotten vaccines from other sources. So the Italian supply is not so vital to them. But it does show, in the case of Italy itself, acting as a country, not as a as part of the EU, did decide to do this, Italy first, to echo a certain political slogan from this country. That was the principle that they decided to go to. And it's not an encouraged one. I mean, as Britain has said, as it announced 2 weeks ago, that when as soon as it had managed to do the substantial majority of its population got the substantial majority of its population immunized, it would be contributing what was left over to the COVAX program. That's the international program of vaccines for poor and underdeveloped countries, who so far have been very much at the back of the line for these life-saving shots.
You know, and keeping on the pandemic train for just a second, the effect of having the President of the United States, and this is, I'm talking about Donald Trump, whether it's good or bad, his effect...
The former guy, getting quite warm to, is a phrase from the current guy, the way he, immediate past president.
Yeah, the way he acted.
It certainly enables us to to not mention his name, nowadays, that is.
The way he acted, and all I could think of when I saw this story last night, I figured... And that is what happened with Brazil's president. He basically addressed the country and told them to
stop whining.
You know.
Thanks for the lead-in. Yes, it's one of the great presidential sayings of all time. I think worldwide that should go up in lights.
Stop whining. Oh, goodness gracious. Speaking about stopping, you know, we've talked about Hong Kong numerous times. And it's, you know, what the world can do now is very, very little. But now China is tightening their grip. They are changing the way who can run for office. They're deciding who can run for office there so they get more pro-party people in. There's nothing anymore anybody can do about what's going on in Hong Kong, really.
Well, it's a massive. Probably this is far from the best and most exact word to use, but there is this shindig that happens every year. This massive meeting of the Chinese Communist Party's so-called People's Congress. It's very. There are a lot of people there, but it's not really the decisions. The decisions are not really made by the people. But yes, as this has been meeting this week, drawing journalists from all over the world, and they're all very closely handled, of course, and managed. But among the proposals being put forward, and of course, when they are put forward, it means essentially that they're in process of being enacted. There may be discussion, but anything that the party proposes doesn't ever get contradicted by this People's Congress. That's just a matter of historical fact. And of course, the proposals which will be enacted include, of course, interfering, if that's the right word, or certainly stepping into the political process of Hong Kong. Essentially to, as you say, tighten its grip, and also the mainland's tightened grip on the politics of Hong Kong. Not just tightening it, but in the process hastening the day by when Hong Kong will, under the treaty with its former colonial powers, Britain, will be fully within the remit of the mainland communist China-controlled country based in the capital of Beijing. As it gets more and more clear, month by month, the target date of 2047 is a time when clearly the Chinese Communist Party are determined to turn that into, you know, sometime very soon. By the kind of trajectory they're proposing in these details to do with who can get elected to community positions, right up to the city controller, who is of course, as we speak, in Beijing for this so-called People's Congress. She's the chief executive of Hong Kong, but she's very much a place woman of the mainland Communist Party too, and that kind of control which mainland China has been able to exert over her will, in these new arrangements, apply to many different layers of political office holders in the city. So yes, it's a foregone conclusion. As you say, there's nothing the wildest and loudest media protest about it can do the change, but at the same time, I think we can be fairly confident that even though people are getting arrested now under the tightening rules and sent to jail, people are arrested for protesting and for you know, making sure that their voices are heard on social media too. And I think we can see, despite that toughness, despite that crackdown, we will see Hongkongers do it to the principles of democracy that they desperately want to hold on to, continuing to protest, whatever the risks.
It's an interesting situation, and one that anybody who saw this in the beginning knew that sooner or later China would not stick to that 2047. Now, I want to come back to this country, and you've had a chance to look at this country from afar.
And, yes, it's amazing what perspective you can get just by 3,000 miles. Yeah.
Now, Joe Biden, I give him a lot of credit. There's a lot of progressives that are upset. Joe Biden is trying to negotiate with Republicans. He has changed his plans, check plans and everything like that. And once again, the Republican Party wants to just hold things up as long as they can. And it's just so apparent. And it's just, you know, I don't know what people, especially governmental leaders outside this country that are allies with this country, know that, you know, it's an amazing thing where all these votes are going to come down to be 51 to 50, and it really doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, the House, the United States Congress House, did manage to pass its version of the massive COVID relief package, promised by Biden, by Wednesday night. And and one of the reasons they did that, of course, was another aspect of the sort of the craziness, if you like, of the American political system that has been disturbing media consumers and media writers in the rest of the world. Of course, that not just the Senate still being at risk of deadlock, and the Republicans having the capacity to block presidential proposals like this, and they're doing that, they're attempting to do that as we speak. But the other crazy element that put at risk for a brief time only, of course, but it did put at risk the massive COVID package, was that Thursday, March 4th, was said to be in the wildest stretches of the internet, and the craziest of supporters of the former guy, was that March 4th was meant to be the day that he returned to power, and there would even be, to accompany that, another incursion into the U.S. Capitol by a so-called militia, which the Capitol Police took seriously enough to, reinforce the protections at the Capitol building, and Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, rushed the COVID proposal through so that they wouldn't have to sit on Thursday, which was the supposedly risky day. Well, we're a day later now, and nothing like that happened. But it does show the febrile atmosphere in which American politics is being conducted at the moment, not least, of course, that capacity in a 50-50 Senate for the Republican senators to be every bit as obstructionist, perhaps even more obstructionist if they want to be, as it was true of the Obama years, when the sole purpose of the then majority leader, who now, interestingly, we have to get used to saying this, is now the minority leader, Mitch McConnell. But when he was majority leader, he made it clear that the Republicans' main job in the Senate was to ensure that President Barack Obama would be a one-term president, to quote Mitch McConnell himself. That didn't happen. But it doesn't stop them trying to use the same tactics again with this razor edge non-majority that applies in the Senate now.
What I just don't understand is the following: the QAnon supporters. How many times do their revelations have to be proven wrong for them to understand that this is just crazy? But also, Republican Party members that want to run for president. You're backing a man right now because you want to reach his 70 million voters. But what you don't understand is, yes, you can reach those 70 million voters, but what did those 70 million voters get you in the past, in the 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency? First of all, you lost control of the House. Second of all, you lost control of the Senate. And third of all, of course, you lost control of the presidency. What more does it take for people to understand that even those 70 million voters didn't help you keep any of those things?
It will not surprise you to hear that I have no answer to that very salient question you put there. People's capacity to learn from their experience is entirely limited to their own ability to think things through, I think. And not an awful lot of thinking through is going on here, certainly not on those issues. It seems like a knee-jerk reaction to a political position now, certainly amongst great swaths of what used to be the Grand Old Party, and now appears to be, slipping very rapidly into the GOP part of it being such a tiny sliver, and the rest of it chasing those 75 million votes that you mentioned. But who knows what they're going to lose on while in the process of trying to get hold of the former guy's base and ensure that it stays with them, the hopefuls for the 2024 presidential run. It's all to play for between now and then, of course. Who can say? But supinely falling in line with what is, you know, one would think, objectively speaking, is an entirely discredited 4 years of non-success. Where is the great America that we were promised, for instance? When did that come? Has it arrived yet? Did it arrive and we didn't notice? So what will, you know, transpire in the end out of this obviously very considered, at least very, well, considered is entirely the wrong word, very firmly held notion that the best way to plan for success now, if you're a Republican, is to go for the Trumpists, and that's the only way to go. That is really hard to see coming and holding and sustaining over the next 4 years, but we can't know from here.
No, it's just one of those things that I look at and I say to myself, it just, when you add everything up, and by the way, those 70-some-odd million voters that voted for Donald Trump, 80-some million voted for Joe Biden, who was part of an administration that ran the country 8 years before Donald Trump came in. All those indicators show that America itself is not ready for, A, on the Democratic side, a very, very, very progressive president, and they're not ready for a president that is going to try to blow things up. It's just so apparent. I just don't know why people can't see that.
Yeah, well, the push-me-pull-you principle of American politics is very fully at work here. We'll see how it goes over the next 4 years.
All right, David, welcome back to the United States, and your travels are over.
Despite what I may have been saying, I'm really glad to be here.
And we're glad you're back as well. We'll speak to you next week, David.
Absolutely.
Take care. David Taruchuk with the Media Beat, of course, here on Robinhood Radio. You'll find it at robinhoodradio.com. Click on David Taruchuk, the Media Beat. Of course, his own website, themediabeat.us, as well.